hear arguments next in Board of Education against PICO.
Welcome to Episode 7 of While I Breathe, a podcast production of the ACLU of South Carolina. I'm your host, Jace Woodrum.
And I'm your other host, Paul Bowers. Jace, we're 7 episodes deep on this podcast, and the time has come for us to talk about maybe the most stereotypical ACLU issue of all time, censorship. I wanted to break the ice a little bit by just talking about dangerous books. I know you and I are both old dads now, but if we can cast our memories back, I was wondering if we could just start by talking about, you know, maybe for you, the first time you heard about a book that adults thought was dangerous or needed to be banned.
You know, this isn't the first book that I heard of, but since you mentioned dads, this is what my mind immediately went to with that question, which was that book about the gay penguin dads and Tango Makes Three. And I read it to my son, who himself we call a child of the rainbow, because at 8, he doesn't know a lot about his identity, but he knows he has, you know, queer family. He's a part of a queer family. And so we wanted to read a book to him that brought that story to life in a really age accessible way. And Tango Makes Three was a great example of that when he was little. And, you know, today it's a book that isn't in many school libraries.
Yeah. Did you know when you were reading it to him that this was a book that people were trying to ban?
I did know that. I didn't realize that it was part of a much larger censorship agenda like I understand now. But I certainly knew that there was this discomfort with telling a story about gay dad penguins.
Yeah. You know, on one level, it's funny. On another level, it's not, right? I mean, It's silly that we're trying to do away with a book about two penguin dads. But at the same time, what a message that we're sending as a society that has to be kept as a dirty secret or something. I want to laugh and I don't want to laugh.
Yeah. Yep. What was yours? What's a book that you learned about as dangerous or ban worthy?
Yeah, I have sort of a classic answer. So I grew up in Somerville in Dorchester 2 public schools. And sometime in high school, I caught wind of the fact that the book The Catcher in the Rye had been banned from the high school libraries in our district. I think I heard about it from this sort of radical bookstore owner in our town, Miss Michelle, All Books and Company, RIP, great bookstore. But she used to sort of keep dangerous books in stock. And so I heard, maybe through her for the first time, that there was a school board member in Dorchester 2 who had taken it on himself to go to both of the high school libraries and borrow the only copies of Catcher in the Rye from the collections and then just never returned them. So, wow. He wasn't proposing this at a school board meeting. He was just straight up stealing books. And, I didn't know much about the book, but as a somewhat contrarian teenager, that was enough to pique my interest. So I found a copy. I think I actually got my mom's old paperback copy and read it. And, I liked it all right. I thought the writing was pretty good. I thought Holden, the main character, was a little overwrought. But,
I appreciate that you were a book critic, even as a teenager. Yeah. And you mentioned what was happening, you know, at school board meetings. And that's one of the things we've witnessed in the last few years is that, you know, local book banning efforts, they start locally, they start at the school board level, but they've been really ramping up to the statewide level. You know, so these fights used to be hyper-local. You had a single board member, single parent who wants to ban a book. But now we've got, you know, a statewide campaign with powerful allies in the highest political offices. So when you think about, like, it's almost laughable. It's increasingly becoming scarier and scarier.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, the book banning instance that I found out about as a teenager was kind of typical of the old model. You know, it's hyper-local. It's maybe one person who has a problem with one book. And in the years since, those book banners have gotten a lot more organized. And now in our roles at the ACLU of South Carolina, we're contending with them on a regular basis. So today on the podcast, we're going to talk about these local and statewide censorship battles. We've got two guests. One is returning champion Josh Malkin, our colleague, our advocacy director here at the ACLU of South Carolina. The other guest I'm really excited about is a school librarian, Catherine Freely, who has been fighting censorship for years as a member of the South Carolina Association of School Librarians. These are two of the smartest people I know in South Carolina on this subject, you know, on the state of school censorship. So I'm really excited to get into it with them. With me today, I've got two guests. We have my colleague, the great Josh Malkin, who is our advocacy director and who I often introduce to people as someone who's been to more school board and library board meetings than anybody should. Our other guest today is Catherine Freely, who is a longtime school librarian who has also been fighting the good fight. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Josh has already been introduced, and we don't need to puff him up anymore. But Catherine, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about yourself. Share, you know, your background, you know, the kind of work you've done, and how you got involved in censorship fights.
Sure, absolutely. And yeah, thanks again for having me. So I've been in education for a little over 10 years. I started out as a classroom teacher and then was able to take advantage of a great program through Charleston County School District and the University of South Carolina. And I was able to get my MLIS as a school librarian. And so I've been in the library for 6 years and started working with SCASL, the South Carolina Association of School Librarians, pretty much early on. And fell into the role of the legislative chair. And so I've been working a lot with the current legislation and regulations that have been coming down the pike. So I just firmly believe in my students' right to read. And that's kind of how I got involved in this work.
I think we were introduced by our friendly neighborhood bookstore owner a little while back when she was helping set up a Freedom to Read panel for Banned Books Week last year, and was really glad we met, glad we crossed paths that way, and really grateful for the work you do.
Thank you.
So to get right into it, we are recording on June 27th, 2024, and there is quite a bit of censorship and book banning news going on in South Carolina. Superintendent Ellen Weaver's statewide book banning regulation, R43-170, is something that we and our allies in the Freedom to Read community have been sounding the alarm about since, gosh, at least November of last year. As written, this policy will ban all books containing descriptions of sexual conduct from public schools all the way up through 12th grade. So, Josh, what is the status of that regulation today?
Okay, yeah, so as of, I want to say, Tuesday, the 25th, the regulation went into effect without any legislative vetting.
Yeah, we've had a lot to learn about how these regulations work their way through the legislative process, but this was an unusual one in that usually a policy gets proposed by a department, in this case, Department of Education under Ellen Weaver, and then the legislature has a chance to review that policy, and it might get revised in that process. Somehow, that process got short-circuited here, and it passed without a vote, functionally, from the House or Senate. Am I getting that right?
Yes, that's the process as I know it.
Yeah. I guess we should talk about practically what this means. I mean, it's like a lot of censorship policies, it's written in a pretty broad way. What do we predict is going to happen once this policy gets rolled out around the state?
Well, I can speak to the impact on librarians as this gets rolled out. You know, as we've discussed, the regulation went into effect much sooner than anticipated. And I mean, it's summer and most schools are not in session. And we still have school librarians around the state now trying to grapple with the fact that the collection development plans they've created and their district challenge policies that they have in place, that they may no longer be relevant. So many of us have been fighting really hard to keep collection decisions with the trained professional, with the school librarian. And we also worked hard to implement systems that would be respectful of each family's decision of what their child is and is not allowed to read. So even though we may not agree with the structure and intent of this regulation, we aim to follow it. However, being, again, summertime, lots of offices are on amended schedules, we have been given zero support from the state on how we're expected to implement this new regulation within our school libraries. So as far as moving forward and working under this regulation, it's a little nerve-wracking for many of our folks in schools. We want to be compliant, but aren't quite sure how to do that when we have not much guidance has really been handed down.
Yeah, before this policy was even proposed, we saw that Superintendent Weaver cut ties between her department and the South Carolina Association of School Librarians. And she did this after, I think, decades of a partnership between your organization and the State Department. When she made this announcement, she cited the school librarians' outspokenness on the threats to librarians and academic freedom. She issued this statement where she said that SCASL, which is what we call SCASL, had created a hostile environment using politicized rhetoric to oppose efforts to remove books from school libraries. Catherine, you lived through that. How would you describe the relationship between public school librarians and the elected leader of our schools?
Yeah. So, Paul, I mean, for almost 50 years, we've had a collaborative relationship with the Department of Education, and we meaning the South Carolina Association of School Librarians. And in fact, SCASL has worked for years to establish guidelines and standards for school librarians that the state has used for our evaluations. And that's something that for almost all other teaching positions is created within the Department of Education. But SCASL has taken on that burden historically and created these standards. And so for decades, we've created, I mean, literally hundreds of hours of professional development opportunities for our librarians around the state. And they can take part in things like our multi-day conference, our annual conference, which usually happens in March, regional workshops that happen all around the state. We create help docs and toolkits, all for our librarians to be stellar. And SCASL has truly stood in the gap to ensure that our school librarians are effective and equipped professionals with their schools. And so the claim of using politicized rhetoric came after SCASL was asked to contribute to the task force for educator recruitment. Because as we know, educator recruitment is a huge, huge problem across our state. And so we were asked to provide some insight into school librarians. For over 10 years, there's been a shortage of school librarians in our state. And in our submission, we outlined some of the reasons for that, and including funding and some of the structural problems. But we also included the way that librarians were being spoken about in some of the state's highest offices. And, you know, we've been accused of indoctrinating and pushing political agenda. We've been called groomers, both in print and in board meetings at the state and Columbia, and pedophiles. And this is all because we try to provide books that represent the diversity of all of our students, the religions, the different backgrounds, types of families, life experiences. And so because of that, librarians have been doxxed by lawmakers on social media and talk radio. And subsequently, there are quite a few certified, credentialed, and these are highly passionate librarians that have been threatened. And we're not just talking about the safety of their jobs, but they've been threatened, their reputations, their physical safety, and the safety of their family members. So back to your question, even despite all of that, we continued to invite collaboration and partnership with Ms. Weaver, including inviting her to be the speaker at our annual conference, again, back in March. And she declined. Since her letter to us where she severed ties, we've reached out to her a number of times and we have never heard back. So it is disappointing that a relationship of almost 50 years has ended with seemingly very little notice and for no real reason.
Yeah. I mean, that's really appalling to hear. I think in the base case, nobody should be doxxed or slandered for doing their job. But you know, you brought up the point that the context for your organization's conversation with Ellen Weaver was retention. You know, the state, I think by now recognizes we're in a crisis level teacher and librarian shortage. And I think everybody by now knows that public school employees are not paid especially well. But I think of the friends I've known who have left the profession, and the disrespect is a major factor in a lot of cases too, that they felt that they were disrespected by the leaders of their districts, especially the political leaders. And censorship is a problem in and of itself, but it's also compounding a workforce problem. As a parent with three kids in the public schools, I get so frustrated with how we shoot ourselves in the foot over and over again as a state.
Yeah. And Paul, many of us are also parents.
Yeah.
You know, I have two children in the public school system. And, you know, to have, again, back to not only our professions threatened and vilified, but also are in some instances, in some people around the state, their personal safety. And it's just not okay. Yeah, there absolutely is a shortage. And some districts are doing a fantastic job increasing teacher pay and really just advocating for teachers and advocating for more respect with the profession. But if you discredit the professional, the materials they're using aren't as credible anymore.
Yeah.
And it's almost as if that's what we're doing.
So at the top of the show, Jace and I were talking about our earliest memories of book bans and challenges. And it was almost quaint talking about the way these things used to go, which was that book challenges tended to be very local affairs. You know, maybe one parent or one school board member has an objection to a book like Catcher in the Rye. And there's a public debate about it at the local level. And, you know, the local school board in a lot of cases would make the call, do we keep it or not? What we've seen unfold over and over again, really in the last 4 years, is that local book banning groups seem like they're getting frustrated because they bring a whole list of books to ban. And often when local school districts or public library boards adhere to their own review policies, the books stay. You know, these book bans often fail. And so instead of doing local challenges, they are now seeking to put their policy preferences into state law. So what were once hyper-local fights are now everybody's problem. And, you know, through policies like the one that passed this week, one person in one county now has the chance to exercise authority over all of South Carolina's school libraries, you know, to challenge a book and get it banned everywhere in all grades. From what you've experienced and observed, how are these local struggles for academic freedom tied to statewide and even national struggles?
Yeah, I think you summed it up really well, Paul. I mean, we first saw it, I think, in Florida. Right. And now with the internet, with technology, it exploded everywhere. And we saw it locally first. Right. And it was really, for the most part, a pretty nice exercise in democracy. Someone had a book they disagreed with. And, you know, I think they had the flawed belief that their perspective of a book should be allowed to be imposed on every parent and student in a district. But alas, I mean, it was still an exercise in democracy. There was a review committee formed, a cross-section of parents and educators, administrators, and they were all hypothetically reading the book and discussing the complainant's concern against the value of the book. And again, the overwhelming majority of the time, folks would say, okay, I see your concern. There's this passage that is difficult. But there's so much value to this book, we don't want to make it inaccessible for our students. So what folks are doing now is they, you know, they're getting frustrated that they're failing in their attempts at authoritarianism. They're saying, let me go to these extremist legislators or extremist politicians who will champion our ideology and have the platform to do so, I see it as usurping the democratic process.
This is after reading the books, people are deciding to take the context or take the work as a whole and not just take one excerpt out. So just consider the whole context. And I think, you know, what's happening is a lot of these hate groups are showing up at board meetings and they're reading excerpts of these books and saying that these, would you want your 7-year-old child to hear this passage? We're trained librarians. We understand that some books are not appropriate for all age groups. It's relevancy. And there we follow collection guidelines. And so, yes, the needs of a kindergartner are very different from the needs of an 11th grader. And those are things that we take into account. But when you read a passage that can be, as Josh said, difficult, they can be heavy. And those are things that are 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old students are equipped to handle, they breed this culture of fear. And so they start calling it pornography and they start calling us groomers. And so I think how our local and statewide struggles for academic freedom, how they tie into national debates, is the fear that's being bred of the unknown. Unknown books, unknown people, unknown religions, and basically that anything new is scary. And the people in power are trying to capitalize on this fear. And so, unfortunately, that causes people to do harmful things like take books off of shelves, limit access for other families, and threaten teachers and librarians.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the religious element of the current censorship wave. So in national news recently, we've seen, for example, the state of Louisiana requiring that the Ten Commandments or a version of the Ten Commandments be displayed in every classroom. Today, Josh, you were sharing that the state superintendent of Oklahoma is ordering that the Bible be taught in schools. And here in South Carolina, sometimes the religious element of this is a little more genteel. We don't have as many sort of Ron DeSantis or Ryan Walters type figures here, but the substance of it is often pretty similar. So recently we came across footage of an event where Superintendent Weaver was speaking with some friends of hers from the Heritage Foundation, and she spoke in favor of what she called overtly faith-based education.
And I'm so thankful for an opportunity like this to be able to consider an overtly faith-based education. I would love to see, if not the abolishment of the Department of Education, you know, Jimmy Carter's giveaway to those teachers' unions back in the 70s, you know, block granting funds back to the states, because I know on the ground, a lot of Christian schools are very, very concerned about the dollar or the strings that come attached to federal dollars. I'm really excited about the innovation of micro schools, because I think faith-based micro schools could completely revolutionize education, especially in our neediest, most rural communities. Through an innovation like a micro school, essentially a one-room schoolhouse, that can be supported by education scholarship funds, those backpack funds following the student. Maybe we don't have to have a traditional brick and mortar school. We could have something smaller. Maybe there's classroom space in a local church that's just sitting empty during the week.
And on one level, it's not shocking to anybody who's been paying attention. And, you know, we've known her agenda since she ran for office and got endorsed by Moms for Liberty. But on another level, it is still disturbing to hear people say the quiet part out loud. Based on what you've seen, you know, in your work in the state house and in schools, I was wondering if both of you could kind of speak to the broader project that we're contending with here. I mean, what are this superintendent and her ideological allies up to in South Carolina?
I think Josh touched on it a little bit earlier when he said, you know, it kind of started in Florida. And if we go back just a few years with COVID, and we've made this connection before, but I think it's prudent to probably restate the fact that, you know, this really did start with COVID and masking and shutting down schools and disagreements over who had the right to do what. And then from there, it went to vaccines and bodily autonomy and those conversations. And then the groups that had been anti-masking and anti-vaccine then started getting into schools and getting into library catalogs. And so it's almost as if we're just kind of moving along some kind of continuum. I don't know where the end is. I don't know that I want to know, to be honest. But in looking at numbers, so going back to 2022, we had in South Carolina, we had 301 challenges that year, book challenges. And then in 2023, we had 317. And now in 2024, we have had over 700. And we're not even finished with the year yet. I think that Ms. Weaver and those that think similarly are fearful that they've lost power. They're no longer in the majority in terms of racial demographics, and they're fighting to get back control. And the way that many of these groups are doing so is by twisting religious beliefs to meet their needs. And I truly do mean twisting. They're preying on people's fears of being left out, of not having any power, someone getting a bigger piece of the pie. And honestly, who knows? I think ultimately the goal is to spread their own ideology at the expense of others. And we have a public education, a strong public education system in the United States for a reason, because of equity. And I would really hate to see that get torn apart.
Yeah. I mean, I think Superintendent Weaver has been advocating for vouchers and funneling money away from public education for a long time. And I know she talks about school of choice, but if I had to guess, her motivation for a long time, and I could be wrong, has been profit, right? Every time we're setting up charter schools, there's a charter management organization, charter authorizers are making money. You know, a few years ago, I stumbled across the idea of Seven Mountain Mandate evangelicalism, which is the idea that evangelical beliefs should govern seven key sectors of society, education being one of them. So I think what we see in a lot of attacks across a lot of spheres of society is people may have different motivations for achieving the same end goal. Maybe Superintendent Weaver's motivation was always religiously motivated, but now that we've seen what was once a really fringe evangelical plot become really mainstream, or much more mainstream than it should be, I think she's realized that she has allies amongst those folks and is parroting a lot of that language in order to achieve the ultimate goal of dismantling public education. Right? She's at the Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation is one of the proud authors of Project 2025, which lays out a policy blueprint for potentially the next presidential term. And within the first paragraph of the section education, they promise to eradicate the Department of Education. So I sincerely hope I'm fear-mongering here, but the money behind and the rhetoric around dismantling public education is gaining a lot of steam. And unfortunately, I think the person tasked with overseeing public education in the state probably agrees with that mission.
Well, coming back to the lawmaking arena, we talked about this regulation that passed this week sort of by default. But I know Josh and probably you too, Catherine, have been tracking all kinds of bills and budget provisos. There are always several irons in the fire when it comes to censoring teachers, school librarians, and public librarians. So, Josh, I was wondering if we could start by just talking about a proviso that was added to the state budget, which passed just this week, about public libraries. And this is one it's not specifically about school libraries, but your county libraries, essentially. There's this proviso that requires that books of a prurient interest to minors not be kept in children's or teen sections of public libraries. Tell me about that. What is that about, and what outcomes do you foresee from that?
I think it's once again important to highlight that this comes from a place of ignorance, that public libraries aren't also staffed with trained experts who follow policies for placing books. Once again, we see the use of language, you know, undefined language and conflation of language. Prurient is not defined in the budget proviso as defined in law, in federal Supreme Court case law. I think, you know, its primary motivation is to like appeal to a lustful desire. But based on the sponsors of the proviso, and Senator Kimbrell has been attempting this proviso the past year, what we know he's done locally is not attack books that feature sexual content. He's attacked children's books with queer characters, right? So what I think what some of our legislators may not understand is they pass a proviso or a bill, and facially maybe the language doesn't seem problematic. But when you go to a library system, and they are just the people on the ground, the people who weaponize the provisos, the legislation, they don't care what the words actually mean. They don't care what the law actually says. They likely haven't read it. And what we're seeing across the upstate, the public library systems in the upstate, is these really vicious attacks, again, on children's books that just feature gay or queer characters. So, you know, based on hearing Senator Kimbrell talk about this out loud, I feel pretty confident in saying that's the motivation. And he finally latched on to, once again, you know, language that other folks found palatable. But there is a real problem, because I think oftentimes most of our legislators don't understand how seemingly benign language will be weaponized to, as Catherine mentioned, really horrifically target and defame our librarians.
I think that a lot of times, we might read something on paper and think that, well, a reasonable person wouldn't use this to ban a children's book about a penguin with two dads. But then we get out in the real world, and that is very much what they'll do. Well, there's another bill that we've been tracking. I know it's been live for this entire 2-year session, and a version of it was active even in a session prior to that. But we've been looking at House Bill 3728, the classroom censorship bill. This is a bill that deals with public schools and the speech rights of teachers. And it limits what can be discussed in a classroom, especially on matters of race and history. And this dates back to the earlier and still ongoing panic about quote unquote critical race theory in schools. And as of today, it is still active. I was wondering if you could give an update where that stands, what we need to do to finally bury this thing.
Yeah, and just to highlight a theme, Paul, because I feel like we're hitting it on the head today, again, assumes that processes don't exist. So in my 3 years of fighting this bill, I've heard one or two stories where legislators cited as the rationale for this bill, right? In 3 years, one or two stories that likely did happen in classrooms. In each instance, the administration dealt with it, right? Teachers are not perfect. They undertake heroic work. They do incredibly difficult work every day. But teachers, like all professionals, adults, some teachers will make mistakes. And the instances that were brought up, those teachers were disciplined locally. And another trend we're seeing here is the weaponization of language, right? In one of the debates, Senator Massey, who is the Senate Majority Leader, said, "I want my children learning the good, the bad, the ugly of American history." And you can look at the language of this bill and say, you'd be wrong, in my opinion, you'd be wrong, but you could say, well, it's not going to whitewash history. It's not going to attack Black history, but we don't need a crystal ball. This bill has passed in other states where we've seen the erasure of Black history, and we have an identically worded budget proviso that was just used as justification for canceling AP African American Studies in South Carolina. So again, I think uplifting the trends of our educators, our professionals, they have processes. If you're concerned, please go have a civil conversation rather than harass them. Two, our legislators need to understand and listen to our educators about how things are actually playing out on the ground. And now, Paul, to finally answer your question, the bill went to a conference committee. The Senate and the House passed different versions of the bill. So three senators and three representatives formed what is called a conference committee to try to reach a compromise. They did, in fact, reach a compromise, but in order to do so, they needed to add new language. And that is a fairly uncommon occurrence and requires, in order to have permission to add new language to the compromise bill, you need to get permission from two-thirds of each chamber. So the Senate asked for that permission yesterday and did not get it. So as of right now, that bill is not being debated by neither chamber gave permission for them to do that retroactively. The bill is kind of in limbo. This session concludes in November. So we will just keep on watching and waiting to see what happens.
So it remains in that conference committee, as you say, in limbo. So we aren't done here yet. We're still watching for sure.
But regardless of this regulation passing, this animus is never placated, right? Sometimes folks are like, let's just give them this and they'll go away. Nothing is going to placate these folks who want to impose their worldview on everyone. So I fully anticipate that bills that felonize librarians will be back and refiled again next year.
So I'm going to have to redo my spreadsheet, huh? It got quite long by the end of this session.
Yeah. You keep a spreadsheet of bills that you're watching?
Yes. I mean, that's the only way to do it.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate, but when you have bills that are filed with just slightly different language and seems like a lot of our legislators want to sign on to it, and most of them are belonging to one particular caucus.
Yeah.
Within the legislature.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, we're talking about the Freedom Caucus here, right?
Yes.
Ironically named, though it is.
That would be them.
When I was a reporter, I used to read bills that were pre-filed, and it was just a deluge of things that were over my head, things that seemed like common sense things to write laws about, and then some of the wackiest things you could ever imagine. And I would always look at them and think, well, wait, which of these are actually going to go somewhere? And it's really hard to predict which of these bills will pick up steam and get a hearing. All bets are off these days.
It's been a learning experience for sure.
Well, Catherine, I understand that you've announced that you're leaving your current position as a school librarian. And I know there are a lot of factors that go into a decision like that. But is the current climate around school libraries part of what influenced your decision?
I feel like I have been trying to shield my staff and my colleagues by really aggregating all the information I can and fighting as hard as I can. And so I hope that they don't or haven't felt the brunt of it. And unfortunately, I think with this new regulation, they will start to. But to your question, I'm definitely not leaving the profession necessarily. I feel like when you're a librarian, it's not just your degree or your job, but it's literally where my heart is. But I did leave my job. And some of what factored into the decision was really I wanted to do more. And my role at my previous school, it just began to get smaller and smaller. And that was really due to some outdated thoughts about school librarianship. And, you know, I love to innovate and collaborate with teachers and do all the things that I know to benefit my students. And I know what the research says about how much more students flourish when there is a strong library program. And unfortunately, I felt like I wasn't getting the opportunity to make it as strong as I would like. So I'm hoping that I can continue the fight for intellectual freedom and for the rights of my students to grow and learn and the rights of parents to choose what's okay for their family. I'm just not, at this point, I'm not exactly sure what that role or what role I'll have in the fight.
Well, you know, the work you do is a bit over my head. You're way more qualified than me, but I know that whatever you do, you're going to do great work. So I'm excited for what's next.
Thank you. That's very kind and also not at all true.
Yeah. Well, I don't like to end an episode on a note of gloom, and I'm going to force Josh to be a ray of sunshine right now too. So the theme of this podcast is While I Breathe, I Hope. That's the state motto, and it feels pretty naive to say that some days, but I do think we have to hold on to some kind of hope to avoid falling into despair, to avoid just sitting and dreading the future and waiting for it to come. So I wanted to ask both of you, in spite of the odds, in spite of our current political reality. What's giving you hope right now?
I want to hear Josh be a ray of sunshine.
There's a first time for everything, Catherine. So I actually have my ray of sunshine, and then I have a message, if that is okay, Paul. All right. So my ray of sunshine is this, you know, this is not a short journey, right? Their movement to eradicate rights and freedoms is not short. And to be around the state and see the beautiful communities of joy and inclusion and persistence and resilience that have come about as a result of folks trying to take away freedoms gives me hope that these communities will continue to fight on as these attacks continue. So that is my ray of hope. And then my message is, we know that the folks who like to ban books are all too happy to defame and vilify our incredible educators. So if you are someone who is looking to advocate more or to do something, or even if you are not, but you are just someone who supports educators and value and appreciate the work they do, please just go tell them, right? I just really hope that the louder message that our educators are receiving is one of appreciation and respect. So for those of you looking to further your advocacy journey, or for those of you just wanting to support your kids' teachers, please, please, please let them know frequently how much you value them.
Coming from an educator, that is so kind, Josh. Yeah, there is nothing more that you can say to just make an educator a librarian's day than by saying, thank you, and I've got your back. Paul, to your question, so what gives me hope is the fact, this is a little bit sarcastic, but also quite accurate. So, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that librarians were having to advocate for their programs and prove the relevance of libraries, you know, in today's quote unquote digital world. And now the library is considered like the most dangerous place that we just have to regulate the heck out of. So I'm kind of hopeful that all this drama has done nothing more than increase the visibility of school and public libraries and librarians, and hopefully even remind people of why they're so important to society. I mean, truly, libraries and public libraries and the school library, they are cornerstones of society. And I believe and I hope that all of this has sparked a desire in people to read more and learn more and just be better humans. And that's really what gives me hope.
Listening to episode 7 of While I Breathe, a podcast production of the ACLU of South Carolina. If you would like to join our efforts to fight back against school and library censorship, I'd encourage you to join the Freedom to Read SC Coalition at aclusc.org/FTR. That link again is aclusc.org/FTR.
If you liked what you heard, or maybe you got really angry about what you heard on the podcast today, please tell your friends, tell that teacher in your life, tell your state lawmaker that you've been listening and you know what they're up to.
And please leave a rating and a review on whichever platform you use. And one piece of housekeeping before we go. For a future episode, we are planning to host a sort of panel discussion with transgender and non-binary folks from around South Carolina. In advance of that discussion, we'd like to collect some honest questions people might have about the lived experiences of trans and non-binary people. So if you have an honest question that you'd like us to pose on air, send it our way. Paul will be collecting these questions in his inbox and sifting through them, so you can get him at pbowers@aclusc.org. Again, that's pbowers@aclusc.org.
I'm really looking forward to that episode. We weren't able to squeeze that in during Pride Month, unfortunately, but we observe Pride year round, right?
Absolutely.
Well, that's all for episode 7. Thanks again for joining us.
And until next time, while I breathe, I hope.
Yeah, that was, and so I'd like to say to our students who are here today,